This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. Thank you for tuning in, and thanks to Robert Morley for filling in for me last week. This is our week in review program. There's a lot happening, there's a lot of news, but frankly, a lot of it is noise, especially in the U.S. news media. We get distracted by a lot of nonsense. The Trumpet staff really tries hard to focus on what's important. Today, we're going to give you important news from China, from Ukraine, from Iran and Afghanistan, from Europe. We're going to talk about the global economy. And if you're interested in really knowing the major trends unfolding within the world and why they're significant, you are listening to the right show. And maybe we'll throw in a little bit about American politics as well. You're going to get it all on this program. I have with me here in the studio some of our writing staff, Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
Robert Morley.
Nice to be here.
Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
And Richard Palmer from the UK via Skype.
Good afternoon.
Our top story today, China's troubled economy. This week, China devalued its currency by 3.6%. Its economy is slumping. It's really trying to stimulate production by making its exports cheaper. Economists say this is a sign of China panicking. The Spectator says, forget Greece. This could be the biggest financial story of the year. So electricity consumption in China isn't growing like it has been in the past. Because Chinese industrial demand is shrinking, then commodity prices are down. China has been growing like crazy for about a quarter century. This is really the first time that it has significantly slumped over that whole period, and it's pushed itself into a position as one of the strongest economies on the planet, to the point where if there's trouble in China, then the whole world is impacted by that. There's a lot of people who have been betting on China just continuing to grow and grow, and they're really going to be hurt by this. Countries that are heavily indebted to China could really be devastated by a blow to China, which that would include the U.S., by the way. The Spectator says there is virtually no industry that it does not influence, nor any multinational that does not include Chinese land, labor, or capital somewhere in its supply chain. It says the last time China's economy actually shrank was way back in 1976. Back then, it says a recession in the People's Republic would have been of only peripheral concern to the outside world. Now it could drag the whole world economy down with it. Little wonder that alarm bells are ringing in Beijing and beyond. So when they first devalued the currency on Tuesday, it was 1.9%. That sent international markets into a panic. Stratfor says the move is certain to stir up political concerns in Washington, Tokyo, and Brussels about China protecting its export competitiveness. The gentleman, this is a very interesting development here. We talk a lot about China's importance in the emerging world order. And some might look at this and say, well, this is counter to that trend. But there are actually several ways that this could easily hasten events that we forecast with respect to Asia and really other nations around the world. Any thoughts, initial thoughts on this trend?
Yeah, sure. The devaluation that China did with its currency, 1.9% the first day and another percent the last day, 3.6, that might not sound like a lot to some people out there. But in terms of the yuan, this is one of the biggest events in the history of the relationship between China's yuan and U.S. dollar. If you recall, the yuan is pegged to the dollar. So the values they follow each other. But here, for this first time, China has decided that it's going to let the yuan float or stop intervening the way it has in the past. And it's dropped 3% in just a matter of days. And people are looking at this and wondering, how much more do we have to go? Because if this does continue, like a lot of other currencies have devalued against the dollar this year, we could be looking at major currency wars. And after currency wars, we're talking trade wars, and we know how destructive that can be. You can go back to the 1930s and see what happened back then.
Well, let's just talk about some of these other currencies. What else? The dollar has been strengthening against several other currencies. The other ones are far more significant, but maybe in less use globally in global markets. But what?
It's been a dramatic year. Pretty much everywhere you look, currencies have been devaluing against the dollar. And it hasn't been so much that the dollar is this great, healthy economy that everybody wants. It's just that so many other places in the world are having their own struggles right now. If you look at whether it's Australian currency, Canadian currency, these currencies are down over the last couple of years 30-40% against the US dollar. So they've fallen much more rapidly. Look at the euro, it's down 30% or more against the dollar. But what shocked the markets here is that China is not supposed to devalue against the dollar. This is the trade deal they basically signed up with the United States. And now it's looking like China might be taking a page out of the playbook of these other countries because their economy's in trouble. They're slowing down so dramatically. Analysts saying it still might be positive growth this year. But the world's used to China growing at 7, 8, 9%. And when that stops and they're growing maybe at 1 or 2 or 3%, that just throws everything out of whack. And that's the calculations people are making. Is China actually going to devalue their currency by 30% to try to start selling more exports to the world? And if it does, what's the United States going to do? Are we going to respond?
3.6% in and of itself isn't necessarily going to have huge implications, but really what's concerning investors, what's concerning the markets, and what's concerning governments around the world is what does this tell us about China's future, about the future of the global economy? And these moves economically have major geopolitical implications. One thing that we've been talking about quite a lot is just how much economic necessity, economic changes, and economic crises precipitate geopolitical crises, especially with respect to the United States. The United States is so bound up with China, already a huge, huge importer of Chinese goods, very strong trade imbalance between the United States and China, and heavily indebted to China. What are the implications for the United States economy if China continues down this path?
Well, the world used to hear people talking about if the United States catches a cold or sneezes, the world catches a cold. Well, people are taking a look at China now, are wondering if that doesn't apply to China. If China sneezes, what happens to the rest of the world? What happens to America? And one of the things hanging over the markets is the fact that China has a couple of $1 trillion worth of U.S. Government bonds. This is money that the United States owes China. And if China's getting in trouble, what does it do? Where does it go to get the money? Does it start selling some of those assets? What's going to happen? So there's that cloud hanging over the market. And then, as you said, economic problems historically lead to geopolitical problems. You saw in the 30s, in the lead up to World War II. You see this many times in history. So that's the big question.
I think that's especially the case for China, that about economic problems leading to geopolitical problems. And one point that Stratfor's made quite a few times is that China has 1 billion people. So if unemployment goes up by 1%, that's an extra 10 million people out of work. Even if it goes up 0.1%, that's an extra million people out of work. So it's very easy to get huge social pressures within China very quickly. And then, like you said, in the 1930s, that led to huge instability and then very destructive war. And it's easy to see how China could be pushed on a similar path. If they're getting big mass unrest, one solution is to up employment by employing a bunch of those people in the army. Another potential quote-unquote solution would be to become far more authoritarian and to really crack down on any protests, any dissent. So there are a lot of potential dangers for China here.
Yeah, just to build on that, one pattern that we've seen over the years, especially in Asian states, is that when a nation is suffering internal domestic kind of problems, economic hardships, they very often try to distract their populations from it by becoming more aggressive, by pushing against their neighbors, by stirring up nationalism in their nations. And they can say, you know, sure, we're suffering a little bit, but right now your country needs you to be bold and to withstand some of these hardships and also throw your weight behind what the government's trying to do here, you know, in the South China Sea, for example. We're trying to take some more territories so that we can overcome these economic hardships. If we can build up Chinese power abroad, then you won't be feeling as much, you know, economic hardship or suffering as the case may be.
It seems like that's kind of what you see happening in Russia at this point, as hardship is setting in because of sanctions and so on. Nationalism is rising. The appeal of the establishment and the politicians to the patriotism of the people is rising.
That's right. It's happening to an incredible degree in Russia, and Vladimir Putin has just been able to orchestrate that so powerfully, so skillfully, that the people love him despite the decline of the Russian economy and some of the discomfort that they're feeling there.
This really gives you an amazing picture of just how interconnected the global economy is, that and how powerful China has become, that instability there has such a dramatic effect and has so many people quaking in their economic boots watching what's happening over there, to a degree that we really have not seen. We really haven't seen the dramatic implications, global implications of a major disaster happening. We just get these tremors that give us premonitions, that give us a bit of an idea of what is over the horizon once more cataclysmic economic quakes take place.
Yes, that's right. And I think that this piece in the Spectator brings out something really significant where it says, China's economic troubles today are nothing for the rest of the world to feel smug about. And then it says, a blowout in one or more of its tires would hurt everyone, from indebted multinationals who have bet heavily on continued Chinese growth to over-leveraged nation states whose finances would be devastated by another slump.
It does seem, I don't know what your thought is on this, Robert. We don't have too much more time to talk about this, but it seems like there are a lot of ways that China has positioned itself to be able to weather these kinds of storms with, say, getting the corner of the market on certain resources, distributing its wealth in several nations around the world, and having a much more sort of forward-thinking policy in terms of what it's doing with its money, and the fact that it is not an indebted nation, it is not beholden to other nations. It really can kind of set its own destiny in a sense, much more than a lot of nations would be able to.
Yes, we have seen bits and pieces of this already. China is able to take advantage of these opportunities because, as you said, it has the financial firepower to do so, and we are seeing a lot of their big, ginormous corporations, state-owned corporations, taking advantage of, for example, lower commodity prices. If you look around this world, as you mentioned earlier, coal prices, oil prices, iron ore, plummeting to levels we haven't seen in decades. And some of their companies have been making some pretty big acquisitions of late, snapping up everything from gold mining companies to resources, zinc and platinum groups in the Congo and Zimbabwe and other places, and in Mongolia as well. So I think they are taking a longer term view of the situation than we tend to do in the West.
Very interesting story. Lots of important implications. We'll definitely have to keep our eyes on it, and especially just to see what are the geopolitical effects of what happens economically in China. I think it could really hit a lot of nations around the world in ways that would be very significant. We're talking about China. We're in Asia. We're going to stay there as we just move over to an overview of other important headlines from Asia. Jeremiah, can you give us the overview?
Sure. China's central bank this week allowed usage of Russia's currency, the ruble, in a city on the Russia-China border. This is the very first time China has ever allowed a foreign currency to be traded in one of its cities, and it just really shows how quickly that cooperation between Russia and China is increasing. Then this week, we also learned that Russia and China, according to U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, are probably reading Mr. Kerry's emails. That's what he said on Tuesday. He explained that he thinks hacking and cyber espionage have become just so commonplace that basically everything he writes is probably being read by these nations that really long for the end of the United States. This is something that America should be taking really firm action against. But instead, Kerry said, America is trying, here's a quote, trying to create a code of conduct that hopefully could rein some of it in. The weakest imaginable response to these brazen acts, which are truly acts of war.
What does he mean, create a code of conduct? Is he talking about his own conduct or like...
I think international conduct. Hey, guys, here are the rules. Let's try to abide by these. This is...
And hopefully that might rein some of it in.
Hopefully it might rein some of it in. Also this week, we saw that China has planned a total of 100 military exercises just for this year. This is a stark increase over previous years, and it's happening basically in response to America's pivot to Asia, and also as China increases its claims to disputed territories.
The top story from Asia in your view this week? Apart from the one that we've already talked about, we've been talking about Asia. But
Yeah. Apart from that one, I would say the big story is that Russia's aggression in East Ukraine is still raging, and the Washington Times says it may be just about to blow into full-scale war. The Ukraine crisis is a story that has sort of dropped out of U.S. headlines for the most part, but that's not because the conflict has been resolved. We've just sort of gotten used to it, although it has cooled in some ways. Listeners may remember that Ukraine had been working for several years to become a part of Europe's Eastern Partnership Program. But then in November of 2013, Ukraine abruptly decided to pull out of that EU deal. And this abrupt decision was the result of Russia interfering behind the scenes. And so when the Ukrainian government caved into Russia and just made this historic about-face, the people in the western parts of Ukraine especially staged massive protests. They felt really betrayed, they felt oppressed, they were terrified of Russia's lengthening authoritarian shadow, and they wanted to wiggle out from underneath Russia's thumb. But Russia and Russian President Vladimir Putin will not let Ukraine develop closer ties with Europe. Back in 2005, Putin very famously said that he believes the demise of the Soviet Empire was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. And so he not only mourns the USSR's collapse, but he is bent on rebuilding it and restoring the glory of Imperial Russia. And so he's made those goals clear back in 2008 with the invasion into Georgia. And now he's doing everything he can in Ukraine to prevent the Ukrainians from drawing closer to Europe and developing closer ties with Europe. So that's really what's been driving the whole Ukraine conflict. And even though it's not getting as much coverage in the Western press, there have been about 7,000 people killed, close to that number so far. And the situation remains incredibly volatile. I just want to read a part of this Washington Times article that appears in the Trumpet Weekly this week. It says, "It seems the mask of a ceasefire has come off in East Ukraine. The violence is flaring as the Minsk peace process stalls, with each side looking to exploit the lull in the fighting to reinforce positions and prepare for the next phase of the conflict. The situation appears to be heading back to full-scale war." And then the article gets into something deeply significant, which is the response that we can expect from Europe. It says, "It's hard to see how Europe could put the genie back in the bottle if the Minsk peace process fails completely. Russia would have no choice but to openly back the rebels if this happens. And if Mariupol falls under rebel control, the entire scope of the conflict could be changed completely, with Moscow no longer able to deny its involvement." And then it says that Europe could basically just be drawn in militarily as well. That piece ends by saying, "The ability of political leaders to ignore what's happening in East Ukraine may not last long. the first shooting war between two nations in Europe since World War II could be about to get a whole lot harder.
That's a really interesting story. You know, I'd like to just go ahead and tie this right in with Richard's piece that he wants to bring to our attention. So Richard, Jeremiah here, he's talking about just how troubling this is to Europe to watch this happening on its eastern border. And this is obviously something that we've drawn attention to several times. Can you just tell us, we'll just transition into the European segment here. What happened in Europe this week that that really ties in with what Jeremiah is talking about?
Right. Well, the big story I did want to talk about this week was a paper published by European Council on Foreign Relations is the name of the think tank. And De Corsi is intent to this paper, and there are a whole number of significant things about that. But the one that ties in directly with Jeremiah is, yes, it talked about Europe and Ukraine and how one of the biggest problems and crises facing Europe in foreign policy right now is how to deal with Russia and how to deal with that eastern border. And especially for Germany, this creates quite a bit of a dilemma because those former Soviet nations in Central and Eastern Europe are really and genuinely very scared of Russia. Germany, on the other hand, isn't so much. I think they want to also have a business relationship with Russia. There's a very potentially very profitable relationship there. And so what this article talks about is much more of a realistic relation or a realist policy with Russia. So it says that the EU should articulate that at the end of the day, we want to have a functioning relationship with Russia, if not based on shared values, then at least organized in ways which allows Europe not to undermine its own values. And this echoes sentiment by an official German think tank that we wrote about on our website a month or two ago. And so what we see happening here is two separate forces. So Europe is scared by Russia. However, they're not really in a position where they're strong enough to respond with the force necessary. And so instead, they're working to negotiate. Meanwhile, Eastern Europe wants a much stronger response. And so they're not getting it, but that fear of Russia is forcing them to draw closer to Europe and to Central Europe. And actually, that does tie into a smaller story I also wanted to bring up.
Before we move on, the quote that really struck me from this paper, it says Europe's first priority, as they're assessing all of Europe's defense needs and their security needs, it says Europe's first priority must be to limit the damage caused by the crises on its eastern and southern borders. De Corsi says that is the crisis with Russia over Ukraine and Crimea and the migration crisis caused by instability in North Africa and the Middle East. But this, we talk about this prophecy that Europe is going to be troubled by tidings out of the East and mm-hmm. this continual agitation that's occurring on its eastern frontier because of what Russia is doing that is forcing it to react. And here, this paper, these guys are supposedly they're the more dovish or kind of more realist in De Corsi's terms than some of the other European think tanks or those that are contemplating Europe's future and its security needs. But they still recognize this is the top threat that we need to be concerned about here.
Yes, and ultimately in any consideration of strategic threats, Russia is just about the biggest existential threat that there is, both to Europe and to the United States. So you can see why they give it prime position, and especially then they've got that proximity to Russia that the United States just doesn't have.
You know, it's really like we've been talking about the way that Poland has been responding to these threats from Russia and just how they're rushing into Germany's arms and trying to create this these defense cooperative efforts and merging their militaries and that type of thing. That's a direct response to what they see coming from Moscow.
Mm-hmm. And just this week, you had the foreign policy advisor to Poland's new president gave an interview, and he made some very strong comments about how Poland needs to rely on Germany, draw close to Germany, how friendly relationships with Germany needs to be one of Poland's top foreign policy priorities. So that is evidence of exactly that trend.
Was there anything else about this paper that you wanted to bring out? Yeah.
Yeah, well, the other thing that I really wanted to draw attention to is a huge part of the message of this paper is basically America is useless, so we need to get our act together and look after ourselves. And these quotes on America coming from not an op-ed writer who's trying to draw headlines, but a serious and sober think tank, are really quite dramatic. It says America has not only turned inwards and towards Asia, it is also dealing with the effects of a Congress so tethered to a small clique of donors that has become more divorced than ever from global realities. So this is Europe really condemning American foreign policy. It also says the current picture is one of continental drift as Americans and Europeans become decreasingly capable or interested in working together effectively in a more contested world. And then it says too often in recent decades, Europeans have been content to tag along beside the U.S. in international affairs. A new, more realistic transatlantic bargain will require a stronger European sense of Europe's own interests and identities. In a world of many problems, America needs partners, not followers.
Strong words. Yeah,
they're talking about a major break with America and with American foreign policy goals.
Before we conclude this segment, were there any other headlines from Europe that struck you, just the overview of European affairs this week?
Yeah, just a couple. I mentioned one already about that Polish foreign policy advisor. The German army is going to try and do more to get its act together. They've announced plans to spend $6 billion, or they've reallocated $6 billion from their existing military budget to become more effective and more efficient in how they use their equipment. So our listeners may be familiar with a few embarrassing situations the German army's had over the past few months. They've shown up at military exercises without guns. They've had pretty big problems with equipment breaking down. So it seems like they're really taking that seriously and they're starting to fix that. And then the final thing I'll mention quickly is the Greek bailout looks like it's going through. It's been approved in Greece and now it's getting approved in European parliaments. That process still has to take place over the next week or so, but it's looking like we'll see Greece quieten down for a while now.
The articles that we're talking about on this Trumpet Hour Week in Review, these are all included in this week's Trumpet Weekly. This is a high-quality report that we produce each week with what we view as the most significant stories from around the world. I want to encourage you to subscribe to this free weekly news service. If you just go online to thetrumpet.com and become a subscriber to The Trumpet Weekly, we will send it to you in your email inbox every Friday. Coming up, the news from the Middle East and America, and later on in the program, our lightning round of important headlines from all our panelists. We will be back in a moment.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
You're listening to our Week in Review program, looking at the big stories from around the world this past week. We're going to turn our attention now to the Middle East. We'll bring in our Middle East man, Brent Noctegal, to the discussion. Brent, can you give us the overview of important headlines?
Sure, just a couple of stories. The Middle East got a little bit more dangerous this past week. The United States believes that the Islamic State militants attacked Kurdish forces in Iraq using mustard gas, that banned chemical weapon. Up to this point, we haven't seen chemical weapons being used by the Islamic State. We know they've been used by Saddam Hussein and even the Syrian regime, but now the terrorists have them. So they've used, it looks like, mustard gas, and then they also used last week chlorine gas in another attack. So we can see here that where this could lead, we're not too sure, but we know that the Assad regime and the Syrian government just becomes a whole lot better candidate to rule Syria when you've got the terrorists that are using these chemical weapons. The second story relates here to a paper that was put out by the European Council on Foreign Relations, the same think tank that put out the paper Richard mentioned earlier. And this is a think tank where European governments tend to follow in line of the recommendations that they propose. And one proposition as far as Israel goes was that it proposed that European banks and the European banking system at large boycott the Israeli banks that operate in what it called the occupied territories. Now, this is a big movement that you see throughout Europe and even some in the United States, where people and companies are trying to boycott Israeli companies that work inside these disputed areas. Now, this isn't just the West Bank. This includes all their occupied territories, according to Europe's definition of what an occupied territory is. So it would include also any bank that works in the Golan Heights and any bank that works in East Jerusalem as well. And if you look at all the banks in Israel, they all have branches in these so-called occupied territories. So this is quite a dangerous proposition for Israel. The Europeans have come out and said that they're not, you know, thinking about doing this. But the fact that this council, this think tank is coming forward saying it's a good idea indicates that the genie is out of the bottle and it might be something that they think about in the future.
Your top story from the Middle East this week.
The top story kind of relates to what Richard was talking about in reference to America's withdrawal from the world. And the two stories in the Middle East really do highlight a specific Bible prophecy that is mentioned in Leviticus, which does reference end-time Israel, of which America is a nation. And that is found as Leviticus 26, 19, verse 20. And it says this, "I will break," that is, God will break "the pride of your power." And the second part of that, later on, the next verse says, "And your strength shall be spent in vain." Now, this relates to two stories that are in the Trumpet Weekly this week. The first that kind of relates to the breaking of America's pride in their power is that an Iranian military official, he said, "We should thank Obama for refreshing us by referring to his options on the table, including the military one. We just relax and laugh at such ridiculous words." So this is the country that we just signed a nuclear deal with, and they're saying, well, America's saying that they have this military option if we break the deal. Well, we laugh at that. They're not going to come forward and actually utilize that military option. We've seen a withdrawal from America from the world, and the Iranians, the enemies, pick up on this. There is no longer a fear that existed in the past. And this is something that God's prophesied. Mr. Flurry has drawn attention to as well.
It's literally a joke.
It is literally a joke that America would act against Iran militarily. And we know, what is power? Ray Klein, he's the chief CIA analyst. He was the chief CIA analyst during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And Hans Morgenthau quotes him in his book, Politics Among Nations, one of the key textbooks on international relations. We use it here in the international relations class here at Herbert W. Armstrong College. And he defines power as the economic might plus the population of a certain country, and then also their military capability, what they could do. But then to work out what the power is, you have to multiply that by their will to actually use it. So if the will to use it is zero, anything multiplied by zero is still zero. Therefore, power is zero. Iran realizes that America will not use its power, and therefore it doesn't believe it exists. So that's just, again, a powerful fulfillment of biblical prophecy. The second story that relates to the end of that, those verses about America's strength being spent in vain, an article that relates to that is entitled, "Taliban Retakes Key Part of Helmand Province That U.S. Marines Fought and Died to Secure." So this is going back to the U.S. And the coalition of nations that fought in Afghanistan to try and remove the Taliban and al-Qaeda from power there. And this week, the Taliban produced a video, and that was celebrating that they have overrun this town called Now Zad. It's in Helmand Province. And this is a district that the U.S. and British troops really fought hard in 2007 through 2010 to rid the Taliban from. And now they're back. The majority of the 378 Marines killed in Afghanistan They died fighting for Helmand Province. And now we see that the Taliban is back in there. So a lot of blood and a lot of money was spent to try and free Afghanistan from the hold of the Taliban, and now they're taking back those territories. Now, this is a quote that I'm going to read from an article by actually Joel Hilliker here, and he wrote this in 2009. The article is entitled Spending America's Strength in Vain, and you can see that on the Trumpet site. This is what he wrote back in 2009. Thus, Iraq's future is quite certain. President Obama's rhetoric notwithstanding, as America's presence shrinks, so will Iraq's security, as will its independence from Iran. The notion that after all America's effort, Iraq will be a healthy American ally yielding a net gain against the forces of terror is fantasy. And then he said this, we can expect a similar scenario to play out in Afghanistan. The surge will likely put a lid on the violence in the short term as terrorists hunker down until July of 2011, when at the time President Obama said he was going to withdraw. But the achievement won't stick. It's not going to have a lasting effect. The strength is going to be spent in vain. They're my words. Then he continues, the Afghan security forces meant to take over from U.S. troops will be ineffective and riddled with deserters and Islamist infiltrators. The government will be corrupt and compromised, which we've seen. And then finally, he says, and once America starts pulling out, terrorists will pick up where they left off. Now, this is not something we joy to report about. It's simply fact. God prophesied that these things were going to happen to America's power and its strength. And that's what we're seeing in the Middle East right now.
It's a remarkable fulfillment of that prophecy. Thank you for bringing that to our attention. We're going to turn now to news from Anglo-America. For that, we'll turn to trumpet writer Robert Morley. Give us the overview, Robert.
Sure. Food banks across the United States are seeing rising demand for free groceries. Charities are reducing the amount of food that they can actually offer the families because there's now shortages. So we're seeing rationing at several of these charities across the United States. The Associated Press reported that food banks are expected to give out over 4 billion pounds of food this year, and that's double the amount that they gave out a decade ago. So our population hasn't doubled in 10 years, but here we are handing out twice as much food to hungry people. James Ziliak, he founded the Center for Poverty Research at the University of Kentucky, and he said the increasing demand is surprising since the economy is supposedly growing and unemployment is dropping. Well, James, perhaps the economy isn't as good as you thought or as good as the numbers suggest. Unemployment might be down, but we know that wages are not up. And even though more people are working, they're working part-time jobs or multiple part-time jobs. In other news, British scientists conducted a study that was very interesting. And this study showed that listening to music during and after surgery reduces pain and anxiety in patients. And this study, which was published in the Lancet Journal and presented and investigated 7,000 patients, and it looked into how music compares, how that affects people as they're going through health trials and how much pain they experience. And it showed that the patients that listened to music were significantly less anxious after surgery and as they were going through pain, and they actually used less pain medication than those who didn't listen to music. So there's lots of implications for the medical industry, and especially in terms of how many people each year become addicted to painkillers if this is worked into their treatment. That's what the scientists are saying.
Take two Beethoven symphonies and call me in the morning.
They said it had to be music that they enjoyed listening to. That's what the study found. It wasn't a particular type of music, but the key was that it was music that people enjoyed listening to. Mm.
The big story, this is actually the cover story from this week's Trumpet Weekly that you wrote, Robert. Can you tell us about this?
Sure. This week's top story in the Trumpet Weekly revolves around the new carbon dioxide regulations that the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, released earlier this month, and the massive costs that will most likely be associated with adopting them. And as we start talking about this here, just to be clear, you know, the idea of powering society with pollution-free, renewable, inexpensive energy is, I think, a very, very worthy goal. And
fantastic.
It's a goal. Yeah, absolutely. This is something that we would all love. You know, clean energy is a hope that should fill all of our dreams. And one day we are going to get there. But on the other hand, let's not pretend that there isn't going to be a cost associated with forcing that transition today. And that's what's happening with these new regulations. There will be a cost. And at first, it will be pretty big. Here's what President Obama said when he announced the EPA rules. He said, quote, "Now let's be clear. There will be critics of what we're trying to do. They will claim this plan will cost you money, even though this plan, the analysis shows, will ultimately save the average American nearly $85 a year on their energy bills." So the president is claiming that by adopting his new policies, by regulating the power utilities, that will actually save people on their energy bills.
Talking about net costs versus net gains, that on the whole, the gains will outweigh the costs.
Well, he's saying in this case that your energy bill will be $85 per year less by 2030. And that's an absolutely meaningless number. That claim is absolutely meaningless because for this claim to have any value, you need to know what the total cost to consumers will be before you get to that $85 per year saving by 2030, that the hypothetical $85 per year. So for example, putting solar panels on your house might save you $500 per year on your energy bill. And that might sound great. If it costs you $5,000 to install those panels, you know, now it's not looking so good anymore. That's taking you 10 years to recoup to get to that point. And that, and then by that point, you know, how good are your solar panels? So that's the question.
Part of this article that just really astounded me was the assumptions that are underpinning these overall assessments of what the economic costs would be. You've got to assume that there are going to be, because we're taking these efforts to reduce climate change, that our efforts to do that are going to have such a dramatic impact on the environment. There'll be fewer hurricanes, reduced droughts. If you assume that coastal cities will not be submerged by rising ocean levels, if you assume that fewer people will suffer asthma, et cetera, you're saying, I'm quoting your article, these are all assumptions that are built into the calculations for what the costs and the savings will be?
Right, absolutely. So the Obama administration, the EPA, has argued that by 2030, if you add up all the savings to there being less hurricanes because there won't be global warming because we'll save the world from global warming, there will be less poverty, there'll be all these things that they put estimates on, they say it will save America $25 to $40 billion by 2030.
I mean, that's like saying because we've saved the world from the effects that we saw in the Hollywood blockbuster about how there was going to be catastrophic tsunamis hitting New York City. Just, it's incalculable how much better our lives are because we're going to be putting these policies in place.
Well, yeah, you can have a lot of savings if you are going to say that, well, if you adopt these things, New Orleans won't get flooded again. That's a pretty big savings right there.
Yeah.
But are they real? Now, a lot of people have argued and said, look, those are hypothetical savings here. Let's look at the hard numbers. Let's see what it's actually going to cost for us to shut down perfectly good coal-fired power plants, perfectly good natural gas-fired power plants, and replace them with windmills or solar facilities, which, by the way, cost more to operate and don't produce electricity as inexpensively as coal and natural gas do.
I want to extend an invitation to you, Robert, to continue this conversation. I'd really like to talk about this more. Let's say next Wednesday, for Trumpet Hour next Wednesday, we've got a big EPA regulatory conversation on our plate.
Sounds good.
All right. Thank you, Robert. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. You can go there to receive a free subscription to this weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The cover story this week is Robert's article about the EPA, President Obama's clean energy dream or national nightmare. All of the stories we're talking about on today's program are in this report. We're going to finish the program next with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
I'll start with a brief travel tip from the World Economic Forum's Travel and Tourism Report. If you're trying to figure out where to take your vacation, this group put out a list of the 10 most expensive and least expensive vacation destinations for tourists. The 10 most expensive, from the most to the least, probably not a big shock: Switzerland, United Kingdom, France, Australia, Norway, Israel, Denmark, Sweden, Italy, Austria. If you're on a budget, you got to stay away from those countries. The 10 cheapest destinations. Are you ready for this? Number one, Iran, Egypt, Indonesia, Yemen, the Gambia, Malaysia, Tunisia, India, Pakistan, Algeria. If you want a real travel bargain, book that getaway to Tehran today. It's time now for our lightning round. One last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention. We'll begin with Jeremiah.
On Friday, Russia urged the United States to scrap plans to station parts of a missile shield system in Europe since Iran has agreed to limit its nuclear program. This is a fascinating story to me because it shows Russia calling America's bluff on the missile shield system. The U.S. has always said the purpose of the missile shield system is to protect European nations not from Russia, but from Iran. The U.S. has said that it is just kind of a side effect that the system could also counter Russian missiles. Well, analysts have seen through this U.S. claim, and they acknowledge that the missile defense system is designed to protect against both Iran and Russia, but Washington has never admitted that. Well, now Russia is calling the United States' bluff. You know, you said this system is designed to protect from Iran. Well, now the Iran deal means that the threat from Iran is neutralized, so you need to scrap this whole shield. We've seen the Obama administration back down to Russia on major aspects of this European missile shield system. And now with Washington's bluff called, I think it is very likely that the U.S. will back down again.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll move now to Richard.
The world is selling gold. Global demand for gold has fallen by 10%, apart from in one place: Europe. Europe has an insatiable demand for gold. Its demand in the last 3 months rose sharply. Germany especially. Sale of gold bars and coins rose 24%. We have an article in the Trumpet Weekly that quotes Alistair Hewitt at the World Gold Council, talking about how the European bullion market has gone from being non-existent to the world's leading bar and coin market. And the thing that I find really interesting about this is who is buying the gold. And this article makes the point, a while ago, it was people buying gold bars, the type you see in bank robber movies and that kind of thing. And these are usually big investors. This time, it's not like that. It's people buying small quantities of gold coin. It's small investors. It's individuals. It's, you know, the common people, if I could put it that way. And I think that's really interesting because it shows a widespread nervousness is too soft of a word. Widespread scaredness about the economy. It takes a lot of anxiety for someone like me, someone like you, to go out and start buying gold. You're going to have some very serious and very real concerns about the future of your bank account, the future of your mortgage, the future of your savings. And so people, especially in Europe, especially in Germany, are going out and buying gold. And that's something that we're going to see affect German politics and that we're going to see a much longer, very real world trend result from, not just an economic trend.
All right. Thank you, Richard. We'll turn now to Brent.
Well, the U.S. government began secret nuclear talks with the Iranian regime in 2011. Now, this was a time when the Holocaust-denying leader Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was still president, rather than the moderate president, Hassan Rouhani.
Now,
the
U.S. Moderate in quotes.
Moderate in quotes, right. We know the leader, Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel, called him a wolf in sheep's clothing. But the U.S. government kind of sold the world on this Iran deal at the critical time that they said, right now we have a moderate leader in power in Iran. We will be able to work out this deal with him, make a good deal that protects Israel from a threat of a nuclear attack. But it came out a couple of weeks ago, but it was reported on this week. No, it wasn't under the leadership of Hassan Rouhani this started. It was actually started back in 2011 with Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And he, as I said already... A wolf in wolf's clothing. He wanted destroyers to destroy Israel, wipe Israel off the map, deny that the Holocaust took place. And it was America's desire for a deal with Iran, regardless of the leadership of Iran, that pushed this process forward. Now, this came out from a speech from the Iranian leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, on June 23rd, and it was just recently translated. And this is what he said. He said, "The issue of negotiating with the Americans is related to the term of the previous Ahmadinejad government and to the dispatching of a mediator to Tehran to request such talks." So the U.S. walked through the Omani Sultan, the ruler of that country, and they said to him, "Can you go to Iran and say, hey, we want to discuss the end of the sanctions regime, and we want to discuss a possible nuclear deal." So that is totally the opposite of what we've been told. We've been told the sanctions regime brought Iran to the table to want to negotiate because of their failing economy. And we've been told that we'd started this process when we had a moderate in power. At least according to the leader of Iran, that is blatantly false. The U.S. wanted a deal before Iran came to them asking for their sanctions regime to be removed. And they wanted the deal even under such a hard right-wing politician such as Ahmadinejad.
As Mr. Stephen Fleury has been saying, we're getting better information, more reliable information from the Iranian regime on what's happening here than we are from our own government in the United States. Thank you, Brent. We'll move now to Robert.
Well, this week, the Obama administration intervened in a landmark legal case to block American victims of terrorist attacks from gaining restitution from the terrorists. So we have this case where some Americans were injured in terrorist attacks and some family members who were killed. They had sued the Palestinian Authority in a New York City court. And after a decade of fighting, they finally won. They were awarded $655 million in restitution. And they, on top of that, they did the world a service by exposing the Palestinian Authority's role in sponsoring terrorists. So after all this, after a decade of fighting, after all the pain and suffering they experienced, the Obama administration has come out and has asked the court to reduce that and to perhaps even eliminate the penalties. They've asked that the Palestinian Authority be exempted from them because they say that it could impact the ability of the Palestinian Authority to keep operating properly in the West Bank. So here we have this organization that has sponsored terror. It's killed Americans, and the U.S. government is in a position of protecting them from paying the price. Now, these victims are understandably outraged. A lawyer representing the victims said that if the Palestinian government can continue paying terrorists currently imprisoned in Israeli jails, it can pay the victims of these terrorist attacks. So when a Palestinian terrorist commits an act of terror and they get sent to jail, they automatically get put on the Palestinian payrolls. And the victims of terrorists, American victims, are saying this is absolutely ridiculous that they have money to do this, and the government saying that they don't have money to award us for our victory in court.
Remarkable. Well, I just wanted to say one quick word about a man who's in the spotlight in the United States in a big way right now, Donald Trump. This man is adding such an interesting dimension to the U.S. presidential race. A lot of people have ridiculed him, said he's not a serious candidate. It's more of a just entertainment factor, and people are looking to him because, well, he's a reality television star and that type of thing. In some ways, I think I would have put myself in that category, but it is just really interesting to watch what's happening here. A lot of people really appreciate the fact that he's just speaking his mind. He's speaking plainly. He's speaking openly rather than saying the politically correct thing and rather than towing the party line of the Republican Party. I listened to some excerpts of a campaign speech he gave in Michigan this past week, and he was talking about his whole motto of his campaign, Make America Great Again, something to that effect. But he talked about how important it is that we have an extremely strong military, that we need to stop all of these other countries from taking advantage of the United States and laughing at the United States. We were talking about that earlier today with Iran. Just whenever the president makes a comment about the military option, that they view it as a joke. That's something that he really wants to do something about. We've got to stop the flood of illegal immigrants over the border. We've got to straighten out the economy, and he proposes to bring his business experience in order to be able to do that. He said, I want to make you proud to be an American again. And listening to this speech, I was thinking, you know, he is really hitting the right issues as far as what the big issues that are facing the United States today. I think he's locking in and staying focused on the ones that really are important and talking in ways that America hasn't been talking like for a long time. I would say several campaigns where you would hear, you know, rhetoric about making America great and that type of thing, but there's no soundness. It doesn't resonate because it just sounds like politics. But there's something about the way that he's talking that sounds like it isn't just politics. Listening to him, I was just thinking, you know, it is no wonder that so many people are excited about his campaign. There's obviously questions of how much he could do to actually carry out these promises. But I think it's interesting the traction that this man is getting in his campaign, in spite of what I would say are his considerable flaws, because of the way he's highlighting these specific issues. And in a way, I think it highlights just how far America has departed from those values and those beliefs and that confidence and that will that we were talking about earlier in some of these comments that he's making. He's showing these were normal types of statements at one time, and they've become so unusual and so out of the ordinary. And I think it is something that is resonating with a lot of Americans. If nothing else, I think it's interesting. It'll be interesting to watch where this goes and how much staying power his campaign has. But I think a lot of people are thankful that he's injecting some element of just real talk into the discussion. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're at the end now of Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to this weekly news report we've been talking about, The Trumpet Weekly. It's an excellent publication. It really is informative. The stories that we've been talking about in the program today are in there. There are also links to Trumpet articles and to the source material that will give you more explanation on some of these topics. You can send us your thoughts or your questions by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Find us on Twitter or Facebook or Google Plus if you just search for the Philadelphia Trumpet. I want to thank our panel, Brent Noctegal, Richard Palmer, Jeremiah Jacques, Robert Morley. Gentlemen, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Adrian Pierce Rogers. The government cannot give to anybody anything that the government does not first take from somebody else. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.